From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the House moves forward with drafting articles of impeachment.
The articles of impeachment have to really focus on what our founders saw as the most danger, that is abuse of power, the idea of the president using the unique powers of his office for his own political, personal, or financial gain.
Also today, Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg on how he'd take on Donald Trump in a general election.
Well, I'm used to dealing with bullies, and I've seen worse incoming than tweets full of typos.
And from Brazil to Boston, Brazilian evangelicals grapple with the politics of their home country.
There are some sectors of society, which I think is the majority, who elected President Bolsonaro. And the main message that I read in that is it's time to change.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The House of Representatives is moving forward with drafting articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the development at a press conference this morning.
The facts are uncontested. The president abused his power for his own personal political benefit.
Republicans in the House are criticizing the move, saying it's rushed. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
It's not a day that history will be proud of. It's not a day I hope America ever repeats.
With us to help break it down is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. She joins us now from Washington. Kimberly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi, Kimberly. I'm so glad that you're both a journalist and a lawyer today because I have lots of process questions for you that I'm hoping we can work through. So let me start by just saying, asking this. On the same day, the House Judiciary Committee announces more hearings next week. But Nancy Pelosi says that the House is going to start articles of impeachment, start drafting them now. Shouldn't that be sequential? How can those things happen simultaneously?
That's a great question. So what's going to happen in this hearing on Monday announced by the Senate Judiciary Committee is that they're going to hear the evidence from both the House attorneys who are putting together the case for impeachment, as well as the Republican attorneys and the White House, a representative from the White House, if the White House chooses to participate in defending them. They're going to basically present the case and the defense. And after that, members of the Judiciary Committee will begin drafting articles of impeachment.
Okay, so that's clear. So now, who's responsible for drafting those articles? Is there a particular committee?
Yes, that will rest with the Judiciary Committee. And today I spoke with one member, Congressman David Cicilline from Rhode Island today. And I asked him whether these articles were focused just on the Ukrainian matter, this idea that the president pressured Ukrainian to try to get dirt on Joe Biden and his son, or whether it will include other things like, say, violations of the Emoluments Clause or things that came up with the Mueller report. He didn't himself say which he would prefer. That's something that the committee will have to decide. But he does think that it should represent a pattern of behavior by the president. Let's listen to what he told me.
But I think the articles of impeachment have to really focus on what our founders saw as the most danger, that is abuse of power, the idea of the president using the unique powers of his office, which are enormous, for his own political, personal, or financial gain.
So that gives a lot of wiggle room here, because that was what the Mueller report was about, as well as this the latest information about the Ukrainian matter.
OK. And is there a brief play by play that you can give us of the process once we get through the hearing at the beginning of next week?
Yeah. So overall, the idea is to have articles of impeachment drafted. Then it goes to the House to be approved. And ultimately, the Democrats want to get this done before Christmas. They've already been notified that they should stick around at least until December 20th, a little later than they normally do. They're hoping to get that vote done before the end of the year.
You just mentioned Christmas. Yesterday, we heard Georgia Republican Doug Collins. He's the top Republican on the Judiciary Committee. He argued that Democrats were moving too fast towards impeachment. But, for example, Andrew Johnson's impeachment took 3 months from impeachment to the House to acquittal in the Senate. Bill Clinton's was just over 4 months. Is this new impeachment process really much faster?
It really isn't. I mean, it seemed Democrats made that case yesterday at their big hearing with the constitutional efforts. And Congressman Cicilline said the same. Let's take a look at what he said.
when the whistleblower report was filed, that sort of changed the speed at which we were moving, because it was such a dangerous set of facts. The president of the United States really compromising the national security of the United States.
And so he doesn't believe it's moving too fast and that they're proceeding at just the right rate.
All right. So now to switch to sort of the American public's view of this, what is the feeling in Congress about how this case is resonating with the American public?
Well, I also spoke today with Congressman Stephen Lynch. He's on the Oversight and the Financial Services Committee, which played a part in leading up to the impeachment. And I asked him if he thought the Democrats were making the case for impeachment to the American public, especially at a time where President Trump's campaign and the RNC are paying millions of dollars to Facebook alone in ads, really messaging against the Democrats and saying that it was political. And when I asked him if the Democrats were making the case, let's hear what he told me.
I think it's mixed. I do. I'm not sure that the American people have followed this with the level of attention that's required to understand it. Even though I think the facts are rather simple here, and I think that's part of our goal is to keep it simple enough so people understand exactly what we're talking about.
And he told me he really hopes that they keep it just to the Ukrainian matter to keep that message clear and concise. He thinks that the case is strongest when you focus just on Ukraine.
And Kimberly, just quickly, any signs of anyone crossing sides in Washington today, Republican or Democrat?
No, I think this will be strictly party line votes from here on out.
All right. WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So now for more analysis, let's turn to our legal analyst, Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here, as always.
So we're at a different place, a different phase of the impeachment hearings and inquiry. Yesterday's hearings were about the constitutional basis for impeachment rather than direct witnesses, for example. Why was it important to take the step yesterday of hearing from those experts?
Well, it was important to put this in a context, that this is to put it in a historical context, which I thought was really quite interesting. So one takeaway from at least the three and even the fourth expert who had been referred by the Republicans was this, that there had been an abuse of power, which is the president used the levers of government, holding on to the aid, the coming state visit, use the levers of government for a private purpose. And then Professor Carlin went even further. It's not just a private purpose, but it was a purpose to interfere in the 2020 election. And it was such an interesting comment that the reason why you had impeachment rather than rely on elections is that someone could use the levers of power to distort the electoral process. And that's why you needed impeachment. And then the third point, it was not just abuse of power for private gain or to distort the election, but also in connection with national security, which made it a more urgent matter. So it had to be put in context, because to intone, as many people do, it's a political process, suggests it has no limits, no standards. And they were trying to suggest that there really are constitutional historical standards.
That this isn't just the Wild West,
right,
basically.
That's right.
All right. Now, to hearken back to Sesame Street, the old which of these things is not like the others. We had three experts who seemed relatively in agreement yesterday. But George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley, who was called by the GOP, seemed to cause some significant stir with his testimony. And I want to just spend a couple of minutes breaking down a couple of key pieces. First, he pushed back hard on whether the House has sufficient grounds for impeachment now on obstruction of justice. He asserted that the House Democrats hadn't made essentially full or sufficient use of the courts in forcing the White House to cooperate. Here he is explaining his testimony from yesterday to NPR's Rachel Martin this morning on Morning Edition.
It's not that you can't impeach a president for withholding documents and witnesses. You can, and President Trump could well be the next one to be impeached on those grounds. Mm-hmm. What I was telling Congress is that they've burned 2 months. They should have gone to court over people like John Bolton and gotten a court order. That would make it a stronger case.
To the counterpoint, lawyer and Fox News commentator Andrew Napolitano, who says he's worked with Turley, pushed back saying, quote, when Mick Mulvaney, Mike Pompeo receive a subpoena and they throw it in a drawer, they don't comply or challenge because the president told them to, that is the act of obstruction, end quote. So which is it?
There's no requirement that they had to go to the court. And the first ruling, certainly the McGahn ruling, no one has a right to simply say, I'm not going to show up.
McGahn being Don McGahn, former White House
lawyer. That's former White House counsel. You don't have a right to do that. You have to show up and say, here's what I can answer, here's what I can't answer. So to some degree, saying that they had to go to the courts to, for the purposes of articulating something which is absolutely clear. Doesn't make any sense. And not only that, you had the likelihood, as we've seen in other cases, you know, the litigation with respect to the president's tax returns is also clear. The statute says shall turn over. So it's clear that this is a pretext. Pushing the Democrats to go to the courts only means you get the predictable decision, which I said is absolutely clear, and they are just going to appeal it. So I think it's completely pretextual. The position they're taking is, that is to say, I don't even have to show up, is so far beyond what the law requires that I don't think it needs to be tested in the courts.
So there's a piece of me listening to you that gets that, and a piece of me thinking, it feels like our democracy is hanging in the balance. So why not take every last step, every last moment available for every ounce of credibility before drafting and voting on articles of impeachment in the president of the United States, even if it's not necessarily required?
I think it goes back to what I said at the beginning. If the framework here is this is an abuse of power with respect to electoral meddling, the more you push it into 2020, the more electoral meddling there will be. And if this is an abuse of power with respect to national security, the more you push it into 2020, the more at risk the national security would be. So the notion, the time pressure, it seems to me, that they have felt, that the Democrats have felt, is in part the time pressure of an election. Doing this next year begins to look much more fraught. But there really is a time pressure which is intrinsic to these allegations, which are really, I was so moved by this notion of the debate in Constitutional Congress about why we had impeachment, why not rely on the election. And there was a proposal to not have impeachment. And the answer was because a tyrant will be able to manipulate the electoral process. And that's where we are.
So to be very clear, the tension in time in this particular instance is because the crime, pardon me, the high crimes or misdemeanors, to use constitutional language, being considered is one that time favors.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right. And the alternative view is that the position they're taking, resisting even appearing, is not even in the zone of legitimacy. Really, I can't say that again. It was one thing before there were as an impeachment process, and there was a question about, was this beyond what Congress should do in its ordinary oversight powers? You have an impeachment process now. So ignoring these subpoenas with respect to impeachment is really not even in the zone of legitimacy.
So you said zone of legitimacy, and I perked right up because as a former professor, I used to love to teach my students about legitimacy. So let's stay with this, because the other thing that it sounded like Turley was arguing yesterday is that it is too risky in terms of destabilizing our democracy to bring articles of impeachment if it's not clear and provable that there was a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
There is no requirement that it be a crime. That is to say that there is something in the criminal code that matches onto it. It is just an abuse of power situation. So in one sense, that is both, to the law professor and me, over-inclusive and under-inclusive. That is to say, if Turley actually took the position that it was appropriate to go after Clinton for impeachment because he lied under oath, to be sure, that was a crime. But that was a crime that had nothing to do with the government. So crimes include too much, and it's clear impeachment has to do with something less than any old crime. Impeachment has to do with abuse of power, much of which could comprise a crime, but it also could be more than that. In addition, this is a bribery crime. This is an extortion crime. Extortion means coercion. Bribery means you're basically throwing money at someone to do something. This is both. So I don't think it fits uncomfortably even in the notion of a crime. And obstruction of justice is also a crime.
So we just use the word crime a lot. You brought up a lot of different charges. This is another question that comes up. This particular process around this impeachment inquiry started with a phone call to Vladimir Zelensky, president of Ukraine. It was about seeking foreign assistance for personal political gain by the president of the United States. Now we've had enter into this conversation obstruction of justice, perhaps the Mueller report. I've heard people suggest maybe emoluments will be in the mix. So as a former federal judge, are cases stronger when they are laid with more charges, or are they stronger when they have a narrow focus?
The government usually tries to begin an indictment process with a garbage bag of everything you did wrong, and then winnows it down as time goes on. So if this were an ordinary criminal prosecution, you would say charge everything. That's where you would start. And so that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is because this is partly a political process. The more complicated the articles of impeachment, the harder it is for Americans to follow it. So I think it could go either way.
All right. So we've got 1 minute left. So I want to ask you, how would you characterize the moment we are in?
It is a moment of constitutional crisis. Whenever there is an impeachment, it is a moment of constitutional crisis because it is and should be an extraordinary remedy. I think that it's particularly a constitutional crisis here because you have a president who has been not cooperating in ways that no other president did. I can't say that enough. Even Nixon, cooperated to a degree and fought through, took positions that were not that ultimately lost, but were not unreasonable positions. That to say, I don't believe in any of this, is really a constitutional affront of very substantial proportions.
WBUR legal analyst and former federal judge Nancy Gertner, also a lecturer at Harvard Law School. Love it when you come in. Thanks for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you.
All right, stay with us. Coming up, WBUR's Anthony Brooks caught up with Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg in New Hampshire. We're going to bring you their conversation next. I'm Ticiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Ticiana Deering. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks has been covering the Democratic presidential primary race. Today, he caught up with South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg in Henniker, New Hampshire, where Mayor Pete, as he likes to be called, explained how he would take on President Donald Trump.
Well, I'm used to dealing with bullies, and I've seen worse incoming than tweets full of typos. And you can tell that President Trump hasn't quite figured out what to do with me yet. The key is to be able to confront him while denying him the power to change the subject, which is kind of his specialty. And that's going to take enormous discipline, not just toughness, but discipline, and a readiness to always return the central topic of this election to our everyday lives and how they're going to be different if we have the right president doing the right things in office. That's how we get around this president's noise machine, standing up to him when we must, but never allowing him to dominate the conversation the way he's used to.
And yet he seems to always be able to do it. I mean, he figures out how to sort of set off a bomb in the middle of whatever's going on, and I'm afraid people like me all sort of turn toward him and cover it.
Well, the problem is he does things that you can't ignore. If he says something racist, you have to confront it. If he tells a lie, you got to dig up the truth and say it. But the key is to do that and then very quickly return back to our center of gravity to talk about what we believe matters. Because when we're talking about voters, we win. We have the best answers. We're the ones trying to get you a raise. We're trying to get you paid family leave. We have the right answer on health care. We're ready to reform the immigration system. We're going to keep your kids safe in school from gun violence. We're the only ones who are remotely serious about climate. I mean, issue after issue, we've got the best answers. It's exactly why we need to make sure that we speak to the fundamental question on every voter's mind, which is, how's my life going to be different if you become president instead of him getting reelected?
I want to ask you, Mr. Mayor, about what Barack Obama said 2 or 3 weeks ago. He talked about how most Americans don't want to tear the system down. And most people took that as, a reference to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are calling for big structural changes, for a political revolution. Do you agree with the former president, and is that how you would sort of position your candidacy as someone who is sort of several steps short of tearing the system down?
I believe in big changes. I don't believe that boldness ought to be measured by how many people you alienate with an idea. That's, I think, the difference, and that's where I very much align with a lot of what President Obama had to say. We can do big things without detonating the kind of divisiveness that we already see happening among a polarized American people.
Are you saying people like Warren and Sanders are detonating that divisiveness?
Well, we certainly see that risk in the approach to healthcare, this kind of my way or the highway idea. And I think we see it in other areas, too. I believe in structural change. I've led the field in calling for structural change to our democracy in terms of its undemocratic features. But we can do that in a way that actually helps to unite rather than further divide the people.
I want to ask you about why President Trump got elected in the first place. One of the things that he managed to do was to talk about, I mean, I think he tapped into this idea that there are a lot of people who feel left behind by this system. Maybe one of the best sort of issues that he grabbed hold of was draining the swamp. Now, obviously, it's debatable whether he's done anything to actually drain the swamp, but that seemed like a powerful message. How do you sort of respond to that? I mean, in terms of that idea that people are looking for major change because so many people felt left behind.
Well, I think in many ways it's true that American people have seen the failure of our economic and political systems to keep up. Now, again, to me, that doesn't mean that the boldest idea is always the ideologically leftmost. It does mean that we need big, bold ideas to fix these things. A lot of folks where I live in the so-called Rust Belt in the industrial Midwest voted not so much because they liked the guy, but to burn the house down. And we need to make sure that we respond with better answers now that the house is on fire.
So let me just ask this straight out. Why did Donald Trump win?
Well, there are a whole bunch of reasons. And let's remember that he is a historically unpopular president, but he was able to speak to a lot of things that activated and found fertile ground among voters who are ready to just smash anything that looks like the old way. It's not just the racism, the misogyny, and xenophobia that was clearly part of his campaign. It was how he found fertile ground for all of that among people wondering whether anything at all is going to work. And our responsibility is to demonstrate how we can put together a better economy, a better democracy, and a fairer country. And we can do that in a way that beats back his ability to divide people of common interests. You look, for example, at the interests of low-income people of all races in the country right now. They are unified. When I hear this false choice being put up about catering to either white working-class voters or people of color, look where I come from, a lot of working-class voters are people of color. We have an opportunity to unify across the very lines that he's divided people across. That has to be at the heart of our strategy.
One more question, if I can, and that is, so you must be encouraged, according to polls, you're leading here in New Hampshire, you're doing great in Iowa. I know you just came up from the South and visited North Carolina, South Carolina. There you're not doing so well, and of course you're up against this issue. Let's talk about South Carolina, where a large majority of Democratic voters are African Americans. They don't seem to have bought into the Pete Buttigieg campaign yet.
There are a lot of voters, especially black voters in the South, that we find are still getting to know me and getting to know our campaign and who value being able to have known for years or decades somebody who's been on the national scene. But I believe that our answers are resonating. The more that voters, and in particular black voters in the South, learn about what I have to offer, the more traction that we're getting. My job is to use the time that we have in this campaign to make sure that we have missed no opportunities to engage voters.
Just to follow up on that, to what extent are you concerned, though, that some of the resistance might be to the fact that you're the first major gay presidential candidate, and we're talking about a community that tends to be culturally conservative, and maybe that's a steep hill for you to climb?
I just don't think it's right to pin homophobia on the black community when it exists in every part of American society. And it's certainly true that we're talking about a lot of voters who fall in different parts of the ideological spectrum. My own community is full of socially conservative Democrats, black, white, and Latino. And that community supported me overwhelmingly in my reelection after I came out because they supported the results that I was delivering for our community. If that can happen in our city, that can happen across the country.
That was WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks speaking with Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. Stay with us. Coming up, let's go to Brazil. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts is home to nearly 90,000 people of Brazilian origin. And as Boston University professor Taylor Boas points out, they remain deeply connected to their home country, something that became clear during Brazil's 2018 presidential election.
You can look at how Eastern Massachusetts Brazilians voted in the presidential election. They voted 87% in the second round for Bolsonaro. That's insane. And I don't think that's all religiously driven by any means. Expat communities are just often more conservative than those in the home country. And part of that is the decision to migrate. You're more critical of the home country because you left it.
That election put right-wing populist Jair Bolsonaro in power with strong support from Brazil's evangelical population. Bolsonaro promised to rebuild Brazil and restore morality. He also has a long history of inflammatory remarks about women, minorities in the country, and the LGBTQ community. So how is this political shift resonating with Brazilians here and in the home country? Radio Boston's Paris Alston traveled to Brazil to find out. She began her journey in Charlestown.
It's Sunday afternoon, and dozens of worshipers are gathered at Celebration Church's Charlestown service. Pastor Joe Souza is giving a bilingual sermon about a life worth living.
To live a life worth living, viver uma vida que vale a pena viver, we need to understand Christ. A gente precisa entender a Cristo.
Pastor Souza is originally from Rio de Janeiro, but like much of his congregation, he maintains ties to family, community, and the politics back in the home country. Celebration is a Baptist church with exactly the kind of evangelical Christians that Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro spoke about at the White House earlier this year. Here he is speaking through a translator.
I had massive support from evangelical Christians in Brazil, and up until recently, they had no one to support, actually. No one who would be willing to behave or express the kind of faith that was in line with theirs.
But at Celebration, there's a debate over what a new right-wing government means for Brazil and its evangelical worshipers, and how much influence religion should have over the country's politics. Pastor Souza says the Brazilian electorate wanted change.
Things were recently way out of control, like way out of control. Corruption, a moral crisis in the country, violence. There are some sectors of society, which I think is the majority, who elected President Bolsonaro. And the main message that I read in that and I experience that is it's time to change.
He's alluding to former leftist Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was recently released from prison after serving a year and a half of a 12-year sentence for corruption and money laundering. Other congregants at Celebration are wary of politicians misinterpreting religion to their benefit, such as Rafael Ribeiro.
Politicians are looking from themselves, and even if they claim that they are Christians or something, that doesn't mean anything when you look at the outcome of their lives and what they do. Unfortunately, they fool people too easily, and I feel bad because the people pay the price.
Pastor Souza shares those concerns. He admits some politicians exploit religion.
They don't live out the biblical values. They're wolves disguised as sheep.
He argues that those politicians use evangelicalism to gain money and power. Of course, the debate over religion and politics isn't just happening at Celebration Church. It's at the center of Brazil's national government. To find out more about how things are playing out there, we traveled to Brasilia, Brazil's capital. At the airport, even government protests came with samba-style percussion. One woman sign read, "Wake up, Brazil. Let's fix this Congress." Brasilia is a modernist city, carefully planned and spaced out and intended to represent the Brazil of the future. The late architect Oscar Niemeyer's creations are a staple of the landscape, such as the pairs of white, slender, and bowl-shaped structures that make up the National Congress building. It seemed far from Boston, but we were struck at how the debate over religion and politics in Brazil mirrors what's happening in the U.S.
White evangelical voters played a decisive role in sending Donald Trump to the White House.
They feel like that they are involved in an existential struggle against a...
La iglesia evangélica más poderosa de Brasil, Bolsonaro representa la única opción para la gran mayoría de los...
To see how that's showing up in everyday governance, we attended a special monthly praise and worship service at the National
National Congress. It was the day of a major pension reform vote, and evangelicals in Congress prayed for its success. Bolsonaro attended and made a strong argument for the presence of religion in society and governance.
How many attempt to leave us aside saying the state should be secular? The state is secular, but we are Christians. We are terribly Christians.
While they may be a rising force, evangelicals still represent less than a quarter of the National Congress. Those who make up the bloc come from several of Brazil's more than 30 registered political parties. We spoke with the bloc's leader, Silas Câmara, who represents the Amazonas region. He's a pastor in Brazil's Assembly of God Church, a Pentecostal denomination. He thinks concerns about the evangelical presence are unfounded. Câmara argues that because evangelicals make up a small part of Congress, there's only so much influence they can have. He says Christian principles will always drive his politics, and as things get done, others will come around. We also traveled to Rio. Unlike Brasilia, Rio is a buzzing metropolis, famous for its beaches, sightseeing, and parties. But even in a city known for its carefree culture, some longtime cariocas, as Rio natives call themselves, are concerned about the rise of religion in their society.
On the one hand, I reject the imposition of religion under the sphere of politics, which would be a disrespect of democracy and for the secular state. On the other hand, I cannot believe that religion would be confined to a private and intimate space without any repercussions in society. It's impossible.
Sem nenhuma repercussão na sociedade, isso é impossível.
That's Henrique Vieira, whom we met up with in a cafe in Rio's Laranjeiras neighborhood. He's a theologian and pastor at Igreja Batista do Caminho, or in English, Baptist Church of the Way. Vieira also served as a city councilor here, a job once held by President Bolsonaro. Vieira is among progressive evangelicals who argue that Brazil's religious right misinterprets the gospel to seek profit and power. Thus, he says the question is not whether religion and politics should mix in Brazil.
The thing is, what is the quality, the profile, and the purpose of that relationship?
Even on a quick trip, it's clear that evangelicals are a rising force in Brazilian society, and Brazilians are conflicted over their rise, with worries over how they'll influence key issues like abortion and LGBTQ rights and environmental concerns in the Amazon. Back in Boston, I spoke with Professor Taylor Boas. He says there are different ideas about the role of religion in politics, even among different churches.
The Baptists have consistently emphasized the separation of church and state and leaving, you know, politics to its own sphere.
That helps explain why people like Vieira and some of the members of Celebration Church in Charlestown, all of whom belong to Baptist churches, have reservations about the growing influence of evangelicals in politics. Boas says Pentecostals, who constitute the churches with the most political and financial influence in Brazil, have a different idea.
The theological orientation prevails in many Pentecostal churches, which is to sort of make the world a suitable place for the second coming rather than simply wait for it to happen. And so there's this kind of zeal that can underlie a lot of the efforts, and evangelicals see it as divinely ordained for many of them to participate actively in politics.
It's hard to say where Brazil will be a generation from now in terms of religion and politics, but Professor Boas says the U.S. and Brazil have a lot in common at this moment.
I think you see some similarities in terms of evangelical support for Trump. Like, when there is an ally in office, there's a tendency of religious supporters to kind of get behind the broader set of issues that that right-wing politician stands for, and not just the core issues of sexual politics that, you know, traditionally motivated that community.
As those politics shift both here and in Brazil, they will have implications for years to come.
That was Radio Boston's Paris Alston.